listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 186 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, your host for the show. And today we're going to be talking about copyright, band agreements, ownership issues, all the legal stuff that artists run into while trying to create a music career, pursue music, release their music, take care of business, all that stuff. We're going to talk about a lot of those legal issues that pop up. My guest is Jim Jesse of Rock and Roll Law. You can find out more about him at rolledlaw.com. And he's coming on the show to walk us through a lot of those issues. Jim has been an entertainment lawyer for many, many years. He's also an artist. And he's been traveling around the country doing workshops about copyright law and other issues. So I know it's going to be a good one. There's lots of information that we cover, but I think it will help at least start you thinking in the right direction when you encounter these issues and give you some tools to figure out how to get the answers you need and take care of business. Speaking of legal issues, one of the top questions we get asked here at CD Baby is, how do I legally release a cover song? The good news is we have integrated cover song licensing now at CD Baby. So if you've got a cover song single that you want to release, it's super easy. All you have to do is sign it up for distribution at CD Baby. Just go to cdbaby.com, head over to our artist site. And once you're there, you just sign up the song and select that it's a cover song. There's a licensing fee you pay, a one-time licensing fee, and then we handle the rest. We'll secure the license and we'll pay the appropriate songwriters and publishers on your behalf. And so all you have to do is go out and promote your new single, your new cover song, and know you've done it properly and legally. And it's a great way to build an audience. That's one of the best ways we've seen artists start building fans and tap into new audiences is through their creative rendition of a cover song. So check that out. I highly encourage you to do it. I'm doing it with my music because it's so easy now and we take care of all the legal headaches. So with that said, let's get to my interview with Jim. All right. Well, joining me on the line is Jim Jesse from Rock and Roll Law. Jim, how you doing?
I'm great, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast. It's, you know, as I often say on the podcast, I have to make excuses for myself saying I'm not a lawyer. So it's always nice to have an actual lawyer on the podcast who can speak with more authority than myself. Because I know enough to get people into trouble, not really address their real legal issues.
Right. Well, I know you had Kathy Heller on, I don't know, a month or two ago, and her husband's a lawyer. And she said, no, you know, her husband always tells her, no, Kathy, don't be giving legal advice. And now you actually have a lawyer on here.
Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, what kind of law practice you do and the kind of things you work with artists on. And then we've got a whole slew of things we wanted to talk about with relating to copyright and why artists should do it and how they should establish themselves and get copyright established and all that. So let's start off by hearing some about who you are and what you've been up to.
Well, first and foremost, I'm also a singer, songwriter, and musician. I have two albums out, both proudly I say released, distributed, and public. You know, CD Baby's also my publisher and digital distributor. So I come at this, you know, from a creator standpoint. You know, what do I have here? You know, how do I protect my songs? What are the money streams? You know, I've been an attorney for 25 years and have practiced in a variety of areas, but kind of studied copyright law throughout that time and then devoted myself to just going around the country giving seminars, mainly for other lawyers about music copyright law. But frankly, you know, when I talk to and run into musicians and other songwriters, they're the ones who really need it the most and frankly don't know much about it. There's myths that get passed around and that's why I thought this would be a great topic for a podcast, because you guys kind of allude to some things sometimes, but I thought let's just do a whole show on this and you know, hopefully help musicians to get a legal starting point in their music careers.
Yeah, it's something that there's still a lot of confusion about. Even you know, when I talk to musicians on a regular basis, even just this past trip I was on, Somebody mentioned something about copyright, and it was just totally a fabrication. And so it is good to get you on the podcast to talk about what it is, how you do it, what it really means, and all that. So why don't we start out with just talking about what is copyright and how do you really establish one? I think this is the one where a lot of myths get circulated about, is this particular point, what it is and how you establish it.
Yes, copyright is basically how you establish it. Let's get to that question first. If you have a song just rolling around your head, obviously you can't copyright that. No one knows what's in your head, probably doesn't want to know what's in your head. So you have to put it in what is called a tangible medium of expression. So once you write your song and record it, I mean, most music now is put on computers, Pro Tools, Logic. Once that's on your computer, you burn it to a CD, a cassette, you have a copyright. You don't need to register it. You don't need to mail it to yourself. I know a lot of musicians do that or think that's how you legally establish one. I mean, you don't have to do any of that. You just have to prove that you created it. And, you know, this is the most up-to-date version of the song. So that's how you establish it. And there's lots of different things that you can copyright, from just lyrics to album, you know, photographs, covers, you know, music videos. You know, today I think we should concentrate on songs. And, you know, I think the important thing is that there are two, you know, if your listeners walk away with anything today, it's that there's two copyrights in every recorded song. If you can understand that and grapple with that, I think you're a long way to understanding copyright law.
What are those two copyrights? Because I think what I see independent artists struggling with a lot is they don't see the divisions in the industry, like, you know, a publisher might see, or, you know, how record companies work. They see things that, you know, all the different rights, but an artist that's just making music a lot of times doesn't understand all the very specific rights that go along with what they're doing. So what are those two copyrights?
Copyrights, basically, when you write a song, think of it, I mean, I'm a little older. I remember 45s. Think of it as the A and B side of a 45 or side one or two of albums. There's the song itself, what I'll call the composition. That's the melody, the words, if the song has lyrics, okay? That's one copyright. And then the other copyright is what is called the sound recording, generally referred to as the master recording or masters for short. That's the second copyright. The simplest way I can define that is, that is how the song sounds, okay? So one song can and usually does have, you know, a lot of different sound recordings. You may have a demo version of the song, a live version, a dance mix version, what have you. But there's two copyrights in every song, the song itself and the master recording.
So in the instance that you just, kind of example you just gave, live version, studio version, maybe a demo version, those are three distinct copyrights, while the song is the same copyright for all three of those scenarios.
That is exactly right. Obviously, if you change the melody or change the lyrics, it would be a different song. But right, it would be. But if you keep the song the same, it is, it's a different sound recording. So, yeah. So yeah. It helps to look at it like that. And again, I would put money that most bands or artists don't even know about the master recording copyright. And if you don't know about it, then you probably haven't worked out who is the author or owner of it, A, and B, you're probably not aware that there could be money being generated from that copyright.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because that is absolutely true, especially because in the United States, the only royalty the sound recording earns, like from a performance perspective, is on Pandora and internet radio and Sirius XM.
Right.
And, you know, that's what Sound Exchange collects. And there's so much confusion about that right that we see with artists. Like, I don't need to sign up with Sound Exchange. I'm with ASCAP. I'm covered. And really trying to describe that there is a different copyright there and that it generates revenue as well. But you started talking about even defining who owns it. Let's start there. How do you define who owns that that sound recording? Because I hear artists getting themselves into trouble with this on a regular basis.
Yeah, see, that is a question that, let me start back. You know, I'm a solo artist, so I write and record my own music. So, you know, for me, you know, I'm the sole owner of it. But if you're in a band, like Small Town Poets or something like that, or any band or musical group. You know, I think the group knows, you know, maybe there's one or two members of the group that write songs. Maybe everybody it contributes to the song. But who's the owner or author of the sound recording, I think, is a little bit of a trickier question, because there's more cooks in the kitchen, if you will. You've got, you know, the whole band playing. Maybe you bring in guest musicians. Maybe you have a producer. I think at a minimum, if you're in a band, each member of the band obviously would have a claim to own part of the sound recording. So, you know, the simplest thing is if there's four people in your group, you just say, all right, we all own a quarter of the master.
Does the master ownership, does it ever come down to who actually paid for the recording? Does that ever factor in?
No.
That's where, what did you say?
No, it does not.
Okay. Because that's where I see a lot of artists, they go to some producer. I can't do air quotes on a podcast, but they go to some producer
right.
who claims to sell them this package. And the artist, you know, with stars in their eyes, agrees to, and then somehow the producer will say they own the master recording because they actually went to their studio and they paid for it. But, you know, it's kind of this weird thing. It's not a record deal, but it's like the engineer saying, oh, you recorded in my studio and I didn't charge you for studio time. It's mine or whatnot. I've heard a bunch of crazy things like that where them trying to use the fact that... is that giving them ownership of the masters?
Well, all right. There's two different questions there. You know, number one, let's just set aside. If someone is, whoever pays for it, just because you paid for it doesn't mean you're the owner author of it. I mean, you know, what if your site, what if your album's crowdfunded, or what if, you know, someone else is funding your album? They can't legally claim ownership of it because they didn't, help create it. They're not the author of it. So that's one thing. The producer does have an argument that he owns part of the sound recording, because part of the sound recording is production. So if I'm in a band or an artist, I want to make sure that I have a deal in place, or at least an understanding that, look, I'm paying you to use the studio. You're going to help with production, but in the end, I own the copyright to the songs and sound recordings, and you're just getting paid for your contribution.
Okay. So the best practice is just to have like a little one sheet that just basically states that,
yes,
that both parties sign. Okay.
Yeah, I've had my producer sign that, just saying, I mean, it's technically called a work for hire, where the producer, you're just paying the producer. And yeah, the producer, obviously producers, you know, throughout rock history have helped and contributed a lot to sound master recordings, but you don't want them coming back later and saying, well, I own it, or, you know, I own part of it. You know, you want to at least get that understood. And most producers, at least on a small scale level, understand that. I've recently had a discussion with mine, and he's like, I don't want any points. Because frankly, I mean, most of these albums aren't going to be, you know, million sellers. So they'd rather just get paid for the production.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, cool. That, I think that was helpful. There might be more, a little more master use discussion later in this interview, but let's move on to why it's important to register. Or do I need to really register my copyrights anymore? There's debates. I've heard people debate both sides. I've even been unsure myself. Is it really get me anything for going through the trouble of registering my song and master recording with the Library of Congress?
You know, it's a good question, because you do have a copyright, as I said earlier, without registering it. But I recommend it for four reasons. First of all, number one, if someone rips off your song, you cannot sue for copyright infringement unless you've registered your song or sound recording. Okay. So now, again, that's not a common example, but if you want to go after somebody, you're going to have to register it. And if you register it prior to the infringement taking place, like maybe prior to the album being released, you can actually get, you know, what are called statutory damages and attorney's fees, and they can be as high as $30,000 per violation. So it just gives you more leverage. Because otherwise, if you wait till someone rips off your song, and then you're like, oh, I got to go register it, you're just stuck with actual damages, and there might be no actual damages. So it's just a little, it just gives a potential, you know, if you're, a victim of copyright infringement, a bigger weapon.
What kind of usages would fall under copyright infringement in that case for a song? Is it, are we talking just like someone records my song, or they record us my song and claim it as their own, or is there some other things that would fall under that registering gives you more ability to take action on?
Two types, really, Kevin. One is they rip your song off, so there's just two songs just sound alike. Now, you know, they may be just subconsciously doing it. There's just a lot of music out there and only so many good chord changes, and you know, but, you know, it sounds the test is substantial or striking similarity. So they've ripped off your composition, basically, or even your lyrics, although that's not as common. Then the second kind of infringement would be they've actually sampled your master recording, or they've re-recorded some riff that sounds a lot like yours. You know, and there's not a bright line between the two. I think the Robin Thicke case was kind of a blend, you know, when he was sued for Blurred Lines, was kind of a blend between the two. But, you know, there's certainly some famous copyright infringement cases where, you know, the George Harrison case involved My Sweet Lord and the two songs, My Sweet Lord and the Chiffons, He's So Fine. So those are the two examples.
What kind of action would an artist take if they really feel like they've been infringed upon?
Well, I mean,
or does it even happen often enough that all that often?
I don't think it does, or I think a lot of these things kind of get settled, you know, particularly with major artists where maybe you just give them a cut of the publishing. That happened with the Tom Petty, Sam Smith case, Stay With Me and I Won't Back Down from Petty. For indie artists, it's just not that common. I mean, obviously you'd send them a letter and, hey, this song, you know, I want part of your publishing, or you try to get some money or work it out that way. But yeah, you're right. I don't think it's that common. But again, if it does happen, if you register it prior to the infringement, it does give you some potential if you did take the step of going to court of getting some damages.
So to be clear, when infringing would not include somebody, say, like the instance of where the Beastie Boys had a brand use their song in a major advertising campaign without their permission. That'd be something altogether different, correct?
Yeah, that's more, well, that's still not cool either. But
No.
Yeah, I heard you talk about that not a couple podcasts ago. You know, that's more like, well, it's an infringement of sorts. I guess it's just sort of an unauthorized use of the song, or okay. You didn't get permission to license it, really.
Yeah, okay.
Just real quick here while we're on registering it, getting back to why you should register your copyrights. Three more reasons, not as important as the first, but I think still important. Number two, in addition to, you know, being able to sue for infringement and access to statutory damages, two, it does act as a public notice that you're the author of the song. You know, if someone wants to find you to license it and pay you lots of money, hopefully. Number three, it is a way, again, to collect mechanical royalties legally. And again, someone can find you to get to, you know, to issue, you know, to pay you mechanicals if they want to cover your song. And then lastly, it does act as public notice, and you get a certificate at the end of the process that, you know, here's the legit owners and authors. Okay. You know, don't let the drummer run off and copyright the whole album and claim he wrote every song and owns all the masters. It's always the drummer, isn't it, Kevin?
It is. The drummers get a bad rap. They do. So you mentioned getting a publisher. So if you do want to have someone publish your song, having it registered is going to be basically a requirement.
Yes. I think it just is easier, is what I'm saying. I think it offers another extra added protection for you. And a way for people to find you if they want to license your song and pay you mechanicals or pay your publisher.
We didn't really get into the details of actually trying to acquire a copyright. What are the steps if I'm going to copyright my songs and my albums that I need to do?
The easiest thing is to do it electronically. You just set up an account via copyright.gov. And by the way, copyright.gov, in particular, Circular 1, is a good source of information on just basic copyright stuff. And then you determine, you know, two copyrights in every song. You got to figure out which form you want. If you're just copywriting the song composition, it's form PA, which stands for Performing Arts. If you're copywriting the sound recording, it's form SR, that stands for sound recording, not surprisingly. If you're copywriting both, you would do form SR. And the forms are pretty self-explanatory. You know, what's the title of the work, who's the author, etc. The electronic application is cheaper and faster than the written one. And, you know, and then the last step is you just upload your songs. Now, here's a money-saving tip. You can copyright an entire album as a collective work if it meets, if you don't have crazy splits on it, basically. If the owner and authors are the same for all the songs, you can copyright the whole thing. So for example, let's say you have two people in a band write all the songs and the band as a whole owns the masters, then you can copyright a whole album. Let's say there's 12 songs on it for $55. It's not that expensive. Obviously, it's cheaper than copywriting each song for $55.
So in this day and age where a lot of people are releasing singles, is there a strategy that you can do with when copywriting in order to save some money?
Well, yes, there is. This isn't a common example, but let's just say you've written a bunch of songs and you've never released them publicly. Okay, you could copyright all of them as the unpublished works of Kevin Bruner in one big collective work. And then when you do release the single, you've already copyrighted it. Now, of course, this is assuming you don't change the song. And then, you know, once it's polished up, I guess you could go back and copyright the actual sound recording if you want. But that is a way to do it. Now, of course, you know, if you're on a major label and you have a big fancy single coming out, you know, then you probably just have to copyright that one song. But so that is the way around that, is to copyright the, or if you've got a whole album done, I suppose, and you know what song you want to release as a single first, you can copyright the whole album and then just release the single and then release the album later.
Okay. So for the sake of copyright, what they consider an album for their sake doesn't necessarily have to be the actual album I'm going to be releasing. So like in the case of, you know, like I said, we get a lot of artists, especially like, you know, electronic artists, hip hop artists, some of those genres doing singles that they could just gather up a bunch of the songs and call it some sort of collection name, but it's not necessarily something that has to be released publicly under that title.
That is correct. Yeah. There's a difference between the two. I mean, sometimes it's the same. I mean, for me, it was the same, but yeah, it doesn't have to be the same. The key is, there's no limit on how many songs you can copyright. Again, assuming you haven't released them publicly, you've started to distribute them.
That makes sense. Cause as we were shifting towards people using singles more strategically, that's one thing that it seemed like that makes a big expense to try and actually register all those copyrights as one-offs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, it's the, if you can copyright a bunch of songs for $55, it's just, you know, it's not that big of an expense. And it's just, you know, I think it's just gives you a layer of legal protection that could be helpful later.
Are there any common mistakes people make when they copyright their songs and try to, you know, engage with copyright.gov and fill out the forms?
You know, I guess the only one that I could think of is that keep in mind that there is a difference between the author of a work, a song or sound recording, and the owner of a sound recording or song. And I know you know this from listening to some of your prior podcasts. You were on a label that ended up owning some of your masters. Well, they're not the author of those masters, but they're the owner of those. So the form does ask you, okay, who's the author of these songs? And then who's the owner of it? Is it your publishing company? Is it the band publishing company? Same with the sound recording, you know, who are the authors of this? And then, you know, is it the band company or however you want to define yourself, you know, Kevin Bruner LLC band or whatever, Small Town Poets LLC or something like that. So I would say think about that. And this kind of gets, maybe we should get into the fact of just sort of ironing all this stuff out before a band is formed, or, you know, before you release an album.
Yeah, very important. Yes. We'll probably talk about some of those band agreements in a bit, but while we're still talking more along the lines of copyright, let's talk about all the exclusive rights you get with a copyright. So what can I do with my ownership of this song and sound recording?
All right, you get 6 exclusive rights, your gift from Congress, for free. And by the way, these rights are to the owner or author, regardless of whether you register your copyright or not. So if you just never formally register it with copyright.gov, you still get these exclusive rights. So I want to emphasize that. The 6 rights are: you get the right of reproduction, so you get the right of first use, so no one can record your song without your permission first. You get the right to distribute it, unless, you know, so you get the exclusive rights to distribute on your own or find a distributor like CD Baby for digital, for example. You get the right to publicly perform your song. And obviously that includes either live public performance or people can play it on radio. You know, you get the rights, you know, the digital sort of the public performance of the master recording, you know, and that's where Sound Exchange comes in. You get the right to prepare derivative works based upon your song. It's also referred to as the right of adaptation. So, for example, if I write lyrics, I can make a song from that because I wrote the original lyrics. Now, obviously, a lot of people use other people's works, and that's where sampling comes in. We could talk about that later. And then lastly, you get the right to publicly display your work. Now, in songs, you really can't display a song, but you can display song lyrics, obviously album covers, things like that. So those are the 6 rights you get.
And so when you sign up with like a PRO or a publishing admin service like what we have at CD Baby with our CD Baby Pro publishing service, you're actually allowing those companies to administer some of those rights on your behalf.
That is correct. It's yours to find someone to do. And yeah, you're allowing CD Baby to do some of that for you. And frankly, you should allow them because it's this stuff's kind of complicated. And so that's why you should have a third party do it. I mean, for example, if you're on a record label, and again, probably most of our listeners are not, but if you're on a record label, I mean, you're going to just flat out transfer your rights of reproduction and distribution to your label. That's why you have a label, you know, and obviously they're probably going to end up owning the masters. But yeah, if you're a solo artist, you write and record your own songs, unless you find you are your own record label by default, and unless you find a third party publisher, you are your own publisher, and so you need to know about, you know, what a label does and what a publisher does, or find someone to do those things.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for artists to understand what the difference is between all those rights that you mentioned, because like I said, it happens over and over and over again where artists say, oh, I'm good for that because I'm with ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, or for folks outside of the U.S., it may be SOCAN, or a whole bunch of other performance rights organizations, thinking, oh, I'm covered for all these because I have that relationship. But it's like, no, they administer a particular right on your behalf, and there's still other rights that you have that may be advantageous for you to have someone administering for you, or just understanding the money opportunities for some of those rights, like Sound Exchange.
Absolutely. I mean, even if you're with BMI and ASCAP, you know, it's, I mean, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but if you may not even be getting all of your public performance royalties because you may be only getting the songwriter's share and not the publisher's share. And it's just so much easier to have a third party handle all that for you than trying to do it yourself. I mean, we're artists. We want to create. We want to tour, whatever we do, write songs. You know, you don't want to have to worry about all this stuff all the time.
So with joint authorship in the songs and the masters, what is the best way for artists and bands to be taking care of business to at least minimize the possibility of disputes and issues among the folks involved?
Well, 2 things. One, obviously, you got to, if you co-write the song with someone, I would have at least an understanding or something in writing about, A, how's the revenue going to be split? I mean, is it just 50-50 or there's more than one writer? B, how are we going to handle licensing? You know, do we have to agree unanimously on if, you know, if the song's going to be used for certain purposes? How's the song going to be credited? You know, who's name goes first, you know, who's going to be the publisher of the song. You know, what if one writer's with BMI and the other's with ASCAP? That could get confusing. So work that stuff out ahead of time. As far as the sound recording, you know, same thing, like as all the band. I mean, the simplest thing is on a sound recording, you have four members of the band or three. We all own that. But just, you know, again, ironing that stuff out early before money comes in, and hopefully it will come in, is what I would recommend doing. You know, and figuring out who the author is, you know, is something you should do.
Are there any best practices that you can pass on? Because that seemed like a lot of information that, you know, when people are going to their band rehearsal or a songwriting session, they may not be thinking about all those things and just how to properly account for them. Especially if you're not in a, you know, I lived in Nashville for a while, and it seemed like in Nashville, everyone shows up to a songwriting session. They've got their little notebook, and they, you know, they kind of like figure out who owns what and all that. But most of us don't live in Nashville and are just like, hey, my band just wrote 10 songs and I don't know who did what. We're all there. But then if you don't really specify that, you can have some hard feelings down the road as things start to take shape and revenue starts to come in.
Yes, that's right. It can lead to problems. You know, you write songs. It's not a bright line as to, well, I contributed this. I mean, I say if you contributed a word or two, should you get joint authorship? No. If you give me generic chord changes, should you be a joint author? No. But if you give me, you know, the intro to Hotel California, then yeah, that's a good intro. Don Felder, who did that, he's a co-author of Hotel California, for example. I don't know. I guess just before the songs are released, establish, okay, these people authored this song, these people authored that song. You know, I suppose you could do it like I think the Doors and U2 just say, all songs written by the Doors or U2. Now, you know, maybe they divide it up however they do. Maybe they have some internal agreement about band division. This can lead to some sore spots because, look, if the songs explode, the composers in a group can make more than the non-composers.
Yes, that can be lead to some issues if you're all broke and there's some songs performing very well and suddenly half the band is able to eat and the other half isn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a, you know, and maybe the non-composers don't even realize this. Let me, real quick story. The Go-Go's Behind the Music.
Yeah.
I love that series. Anyway, they're recording their third album and the drummer calls the accountant. Now, the Go-Go's, the two main songwriters in the Go-Go's were Jane Wiedlin and Charlotte Caffey. So the drummer, who does not write the songs, calls the accountant and wants to know how much each member of the band made. And, you know, Charlotte and Jane are just raking in cash, you know, from Beauty and the Beat. And our lips are, you know, we got the beat, our lips are sealed. You know, she's livid. They call an emergency band meeting. You know, we want to split songwriting revenues equally. Jane's like, you know, well, maybe on the next album. But screw you. And then they break up for 17 years.
Yeah, it can be tough. I know of multiple bands where I know a little bit of the inside structure of how they have things. And some of them, the lead singer is the only one getting any songwriting money. And it just creates this interesting dynamic where when you have some bigger songs that somebody's getting most of the money, and the rest of the band is still waiting for the album to recoup from the label. And it's interesting. Definitely something that needs to be talked about in advance because it'll break up a band in 2 seconds.
Absolutely. Now, of course, the problem with the Go-Go's is, you know, where the drummer has the better argument is owning part of the sound recording, but they're on a major label. So that's not going to happen. But, you know, there's different sources of revenue that the other band, the non-composers can, you know, can take advantage of. Touring, if you have merch, you know, obviously the master recordings where I think everybody equally contributes.
Yeah. So we've kind of started getting into this territory, but how do you set up a band operating agreement to kind of iron some of these things out? I know it's different than just being like a song by song accounting for who did what and accounting for the writing splits and all that, but band agreements, we've mentioned it on the podcast before that they're important, but People still don't do them.
No.
To be honest, I've never done them. But what are things that should be in a band agreement? How do you go about getting one?
Yeah, great question. By the way, if you're in the studio, don't start whipping out contracts. It'll kill the vibe.
Hey, you know that cool song you just wrote? I want to get this all locked down because that's going to be big. Yeah, that's not going to...
Hey, that's a great guitar solo, but I still own the composition. Can you sign this here? Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to go well.
Yeah. Look, and, you know, musicians are laid back and it, you know, we're in it for the music, not the business stuff. But again, there's no correct answers, but I do... There's about five or six things to think about. Obviously, number one, and we've touched on, how is the revenue going to be split? And in particular, the different sources, the songs, the sound recordings, you know, touring, if you tour, merch, et cetera. Who's the author and or owner of the songs and sound recordings? Who owns the band name and other band, you know, property, intellectual property? You know, who owns the band cover photos, the music videos, you know, the other lyric, you know, all that stuff. Because like I said, bands do create other copyrights, which is generally known as intellectual property. I mean, the easiest thing, again, is sort of have a, and I didn't mention this earlier, but, you know, treat it as a business and incorporate. Have a band, you know, the easiest corporate structure is what is called a limited liability company or something like that. And almost every year, if not every state, has that. You know, who are the, you know, rarely is, you know, is the band just, you know, all equal parts? You know, there are certain leaders of the band. Who are they? You know, how are votes taken? Is it one person, one vote? What if there's four people in the band? How are ties broken? You know, you don't want to think about this, but how are people, you know, added or removed from the band? Is it just, you just all vote on it? You know, because again, bands rarely have the same lineup, you know, particularly if they're around for any length of time. So I guess that would be the main things to work on, at least have an understanding. And it doesn't have to be elaborate, but, you know, a paragraph on just, you know, how these things are going to be ironed out.
I think it's kind of interesting, not only for the sake of an artist that is on the road or has stuff going, releasing albums, but it kind of is interesting now in this digital age that where music has an infinite shelf life, where a band may kind of dissolve, break up, everyone kind of goes their separate ways, but there's still maintenance and stuff that needs to be done if your catalog's out there and kind of like, who owns this now?
Yes, yeah.
Who's going to benefit from it? Because everyone else has gone on and forgotten about this, but someone's still managing it and, you know, there's still a trickle of money or some opportunity for it. And, you know, does it, yeah, just kind of define, it kind of just became, leaves this gray area, I think, that there's like this, you know, in the old days, music, you know, it, like CDs would go out of print and it was right. Just dead. Now it's there forever. And so kind of tying up some of these loose ends gets more important than ever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one other thing that I didn't mention earlier is that, you know, I know a lot of people do it as a hobby, a musician or in a band or an artist, but you really should. I mean, I'm not a tax expert, but you know, you can write those stuff off as an expenses if, you know, treat yourself as a tax entity. Look, touring and recording is expensive. Nothing like buying a Strat and writing it off as a tax expense.
I love doing that.
And look, even if you're losing money, you can at least off, you know, that loss will, and most artists frankly do lose money, but it can offset, you know, money you make from probably your regular job. So think about that, because I know a lot of musicians who just don't do that or think, well, I mean, yeah, it's too big of a hassle, but, you know, it could be beneficial.
Yeah. So what is an easy way for someone to go about getting a band agreement in place? Is there resources online or is it something that you're going to have to get a lawyer? Or does that just,
you know,
make
I
it
have
up something
not,
yourself?
Unfortunately not. And most lawyers probably don't know a whole lot about this, to be honest with you. So, I mean, I would just, you know, it doesn't have to be anything fancy. I would just take the points that I've brought up and put it in writing as far as your understanding, have everybody in the band signed it. And then go make some music.
Okay. So it doesn't need to get too out of control, but it does need to,
no.
It's just more about putting some key items, you know, around how things are going to work.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about an area of writing and recording that I'm still very unclear about some of the lines. That is a work for hire. So how exactly does a work for hire work, and what rights, if any, do you retain in those situations?
Okay. Work for hire. Let's define the term, because, you know, I'm not sure everybody knows. Our listeners will know what that is. A work for hire is I'm hiring, you know, a company or someone is hiring a person to do a creative endeavor or something, and the person who creates it ends up not owning the work. So let's say I'm a company and I hire someone to do a website or, you know, a logo. The company's going to want to own it, not the person who created it. Or if you work for Disney or Pixar and you draw a character, you know, as part of your employment, you're not going to own that. The company's going to own that. So that's what a work for hire is. Now, where it comes into play as a musician is kind of what we were talking about earlier. Again, there's two facets of it. Number one, as a solo artist, you know, I bring in outside musicians. I'm not just playing guitar in my room, recording by myself. I bring in a producer. I want to make sure that at least certainly the producer, I mean, most musicians kind of understand this, but that I'm the sole owner and author of both the master recording and the songs. Okay. And so that's where work for hire comes in for musicians. You want to own and control what you create. You don't want the producer or engineer or, you know, even some guest musician to come back later and say, hey, I'm co-owner or author of this song because I helped create it.
Well, what you mentioned Disney and Pixar, and that's actually where I started thinking about this a few years ago, thinking I'm not sure I still am 100% clear on how a work for hire might work, because I was listening to an interview with the husband and wife that wrote all the music for Frozen. And I was wondering, are they cashing in on all these performance royalties? Do they get to keep any of their songwriting credits, or did Disney just own them all? I know Disney owns the publishing. They're going to do that outright for any sort of work for hire. But is there an expectation that you should still get your songwriter portion, or is there work for hires where you could just be giving it all away?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that, because, you know, that's between them and Disney. There's two ways to do it. Disney could say, yes, this is a work for hire, and we just flat out own it. Or B, you're writing these tunes, and we're going to license them for Frozen. Now, I hope that's how it worked out, or we'll publish them and you keep your share as the composers. Obviously, if you're a songwriter, you'd rather have the latter. You'd rather just, you know, have them do the publishing and you keep your composing. I'll tell you a story about the reverse of that. So there's this singer-songwriter in Minneapolis who wrote this little jingle for a Budweiser ad. It's this Budweiser ad where this guy goes out and drinks with his buddies and leaves his dog at home. I don't know if you've seen it or your listeners have. And the dog's lonely because he stays at Dave's house all night because he had too many Bud Lights or whatever. And the song's playing. And then he comes back in the morning and the guy and the dog are reunited. Well, this like video's gotten like 20 million views on YouTube. Well, Anheuser-Busch did. It was a work for hire. So this guy doesn't own the song. So he can't sell it. He can't do anything to it. So my advice, so this is sort of the flip side, is if you are hired to do something as a work for hire, think really hard about it. And apparently wasn't paid very much either. Because if if a company hires you as a work for hire, you probably can't get the copyright back.
Yeah, I would assume that they're going to own it in perpetuity permanently. No question.
Yep. So the better idea is to license the song, which I know you talked about in your wonderful podcast with Kathy Heller, number 169. I even remember the number.
That was a popular episode of the podcast.
Oh, it was a great one. I mean, so the better option for a songwriter is can keep the copyright and just license it to Anheuser-Busch. And that way it's the best of both worlds. You get paid for their use and you still own the song.
Yeah, and there may be some variations on how that worked. They may want to split publishing or own a piece, but
that's
I could
right.
see in the case of some, someone like Anheuser-Busch, them just not caring because they're not in the business of entertainment. They just want a good song. But in the case of Disney and some of those film situations, or commercials, I've heard people talk about writing and composing for TV and commercials multiple times where they've said that they've used the term work for hire, but then it was just confusing how they described it. It wasn't like, yes, they owned everything or I retained these rights, but the way it just made it sound like, I'm not sure if they literally gave them everything or if they retained the songwriter piece or, you know, so I guess it could be a case by case basis. I'm sure it's happened all across the spectrum.
Yeah. So bottom line, work for hire is it's something created in the scope of your employment or you're commissioned or hired to do a particular task. If you're a songwriter, I would be wary of giving your songs away as a work for hire. But the flip side is I would use work for hire if you bring in other people on your projects. Because you want it understood, and most musicians do. I mean, if I bring in some dude to play guitar solo, you know, he's going to understand that I'm giving him some beer money and he doesn't own the song or sound recording, but you know.
So the bottom line is if someone comes to you and says, I want you to write a song for my organization, my business, or something, that it's just very clear what you're actually being hired for and what ownership is exchanging hands for the fee.
Right.
That can actually even come into play with, I've had that issue with photographers, quite frankly, with people doing photography for our band, where my assumption is always, it's work for hire, I'm getting everything, and I'm not going to pay you anymore. I get the photos, and we're good. We go on with our lives. But I've run into situations where certain photographers are like, no, every time you use this, you need to, or anytime you want more photos, I'll give you a certain amount of them. But if you want the whole collection, you're going to keep paying me for them. Like, nah, we're not going to do that. So.
Yeah, and that's I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, with picture, you know, if you are using a photographer, if someone's shooting your music video, you want to make sure if I'm the band, I either own it or you license it to me, you know, pretty cheaply forever or something like that because, you know, yeah, you're going to want to have use of that video or photo.
So do you typically do little work for hire contracts?
Yeah, there's one there. I have a sample one. I've got a little sample one in my book that I've written and people can check that out on my website.
We've talked a lot about copyright. A lot of different aspects of copyright and band agreements and legal issues. As we start to kind of close out the podcast, is there anything that you want to sum up or advice you want to give or give direction to some more resources where people can read up on it? Because I know if someone's confused about copyright and they're sort of hearing this for the first time, it's a lot of information and
yes.
It can still make your head spin.
Yes. You know, I guess... Wow. I think having a third party publisher like CD Baby helps because then you don't have to worry about a lot of this stuff. You know that they're just collecting, have a third party publisher to collect your public performance royalties. Sign up with Sound Exchange to collect public performance for your masters. Have an operating agreement, register your copyrights, know that there's two copyrights in every song. I can't tell you how important that is because, if you don't know there's that second copyright, I mean, your podcast with Ari, you remember he told that story, that children's author who songs got played on Pandora and he finally registered with Sound Exchange and there's like 10 grand there.
Yeah, we've seen that happen at CD Baby a lot. We've seen much bigger numbers, too.
Of course, when I registered with Sound Exchange, there was nothing there. But
I think the biggest we saw was like $80,000. It was huge. It was money that, it's sitting there and because they didn't know that they had that sound recording right that they finally collected on it.
Yeah. And again, you got to know it's there. So I guess just knowing that and knowing about Sound Exchange and is helpful. You know, if you're a composer, you probably should join BMI or ASCAP. But if you're with CD Baby, that's not as important because I know you guys handle that end of it. So, I mean, I guess that's just the thing. It's just, look, this, it is fun. It's a hobby for a lot of people, but it is still a business, and you need to know a little bit about the business end.
Well, Jim, where can people find out more about you and get information? You said you're doing seminars around the country a lot. Where can people reach you? And you said you had a book too. I didn't know you had a book. What's the name of the book?
The name of the book is The Music Copyright Manual. It is available on my website. Now I'll add this, that it's mainly written for lawyers. It's not too legalese. I'm actually working on an edition just for musicians, kind of stripping some of the legal stuff out. But my website's rock, N as in Nancy, rolllaw.com. That'll give you all the info you need on me. And obviously there's more info, you know, on mechanicals, harryfox.com or other websites, BMI or ASCAP.com for public performance, soundexchange.com for, you know, what they do. Your website's great. Your DIY musician podcast and newsletter is great. So a lot of info out there.
And you actually mentioned that your book is geared more towards lawyers, which I think brings up a final point that might be surprising or interesting to a lot of folks, is that just because someone's a lawyer doesn't necessarily mean they are an entertainment lawyer and understand all the intricacies of what you as an artist may run into. So that you definitely need to make sure, if you're talking with someone for legal advice for your band or music, that they actually have experience in that area.
Absolutely. I do these seminars throughout the country, and I run into very few lawyers who do this stuff, because it's a pretty niche area. Now, you know, if you're in Nashville or New York or LA, you're more apt to run into people who do some of this, but absolutely do your due diligence on that. Make sure that they're just not winging it.
Yeah, because I've talked to artists plenty of times where they said, my dad has a lawyer friend and he said this. I'm like, what? That doesn't make any sense. And then I find out they're like, you know, a real estate attorney or something totally unrelated to music and have no experience with the entertainment field. And that is a difference. Then you just can't get anybody who calls himself a lawyer and expect that they are an expert in copyright law. So very important that you make sure you vet those sources and check out rockandrolllaw.com. And Jim, it was great having you on the podcast.
Kevin, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the podcast. If you have questions or comments or anything that you would like to add or weigh in on, feel free to call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or, you know, head on over to the podcast website and leave some comments in the show notes. So if you've had some experience that you want to share, feel free to do so, especially with like band agreements. I'm always curious about that stuff, or work for hire, as we talked about in this episode of the podcast. If you've had some sort of weird work for hire situation, I'd like to hear about that one. So you can do so, 360-524-2209. Give us a call. And you can find out more about Jim at his website. It's rockandrolllaw.com. That's rock, the letter N, roll.com. And that should do it. We'll catch you next time on the podcast. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.